Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll remember the late Chicago Teachers Union president Karen Lewis. She passed away this week. We also discuss sexual harassment of restaurant workers and how tipping is often about more than just service. With attention on the U.S. Senate this week, we'll talk with an Illinois political scientist about how the Senate is comprised and why it's not representative of the overall population.
If you took all the people that live in Alaska, Vermont, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Delaware, and combined them, there would be fewer people than currently live in Cook County right now. But the key thing is that each one of those states has two U.S. senators.
What is the impact of the Senate's bias towards smaller states? And we'll hear from exoneree Amanda Knox. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we remember a labor leader who passed away this week. Karen Lewis made some enemies, but she also rejuvenated the Chicago Teachers Union. Also, an economist tells us what he expects post-pandemic, and a report looks at sexual harassment of women restaurant workers. That and more ahead. Well, the focus this week has been on the U.S. Senate as the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump is underway. That prompted political science professor Chris Mooney to take a closer look at what he calls the most unrepresentative elected political institution. I had a chance to speak with him. When you say unrepresentative, what do you mean by that?
It violates the principle of one person, one vote. That's a principle that I think most Americans understand sort of implicitly. It's a principle that the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld based on the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, equal protection under the law. For example, in this case, all legislative bodies must have, their districts must be of more or less equal size.
So while the House has to abide by these types of rules, the Senate gets the pass according to the U.S. Constitution.
That's correct. The U.S. Senate is the only legislative body in this country that is allowed to have unequal-sized districts. For example, the Illinois House of Representatives. Every one of the 118 districts in the Illinois House of Representatives has approximately 108,000 people in it, or did at the time of the last census. That means that every district is the same size. Every U.S. congressional district is more or less the same size. And that's because the Supreme Court requires that because of that one person, one vote. But on the other hand, you look at the Senate and you've got, you know, the most extreme example is California on the one hand with, 150 billion people living in it or whatever. It's actually more like 40 million. And Wyoming on the other hand with, you know, sort of less than 500,000 people and a lot of cows and oil derricks, they each have two senators, right? So there's two senators from California with 40 million people. There's two senators from Wyoming with sort of 450,000 people. That is an incredible difference in representation. In the state of Illinois, Cook County has around 5 million people living in it, right? If you took all the people that live in Alaska, Vermont, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Delaware, and combined them, there would be fewer people than currently live in Cook County right now. But the key thing is that each one of those states has two U.S. senators. So those six states have 12 U.S. senators. 12% of the U.S. Senate is made up by six states that have a total of less population than Cook County. You could throw another Wyoming into that group and you'd still have fewer people than living in Cook County. That's an egregious and extreme violation of the one person, one vote principle.
So what effect does this have when it comes to actual public policy?
What you look at here is what's the difference between the small states and the large states, because that's what we're talking about here. There's several very small states, you know, the smallest states, let's say smallest 10 states, they typically make up about 3% of the U.S. population, though they have 20% of representation in the Senate. So, you know, smaller states have characteristics that are different than larger states. Right. For one thing, they tend to be more rural and less urban, right? So if you think about what are the policy interests of rural versus urban areas, well, rural areas want to build more highways. urban areas want to have more money for mass transportation, right? They have different perspectives on social justice, different perspectives on criminal justice, different perspectives on agriculture policy, energy policy, virtually all across the board. There are different interests among, you know, those smallest ruralish states and the country as a whole. That's going to show up in policy interests, so that the state, because the Senate is biased towards the smaller states, then public policy that goes through the Senate is also going to be biased towards the interests of those smaller states.
And this has benefited the Republican Party primarily more than it has Democrats, correct?
Yes, that is true. It's not a perfect partisan split, because the Democrats do control a few of the small states, Delaware, Rhode Island, Hawaii, Vermont to some extent. These are kind of Democratic strongholds, but by and large, the small states are firmly Republican, right? And again, if you think about the states, especially the big Western states that don't have a lot of people in them, you know, Alaska, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, these are places with lots and lots of Republicans. And a really an excellent place to see where this bias shows up in a partisan fashion is look at the current U.S. Senate that is right now trying the former president, right, is a 50-50 split, as we all know. It's perfectly evenly split in the Senate. So you would think that the parties would represent equal amounts of people because they've got a 50-50 split on representation, but that's not even nearly true. There's there's six states that have one Democratic and one Republican senator. So they're evenly matched on representation. So aside from those six, the other 44 states, half of them have two Republican senators and half of them, like Illinois, have two Democratic senators. The percentage of people living in those Democratic states is 57% versus 43% in the Republican states. So in other words, the equal representation that the Republicans have in the Senate, they get with only 43% of the vote versus 57% of the vote for Democrats. That is a clear bias.
I know the rule that each state has two senators is laid out in the Constitution. Take us back to why that was put there in the first place.
It was really a political deal that was done because in the Constitutional Convention in 1787, there was a concern among smaller states, so like the Rhode Islands, Connecticut's, and so forth, that they would be dominated by the large states, especially Virginia, which was the largest state in those days, because the large states, a lot of people in them, and they thought if everything was majority rule, like the U.S. in Congress, then the large states would dominate the small states. And, you know, on a one person, one vote principle, that's as it should be, right? Why should, you know, Rhode Island's small population be able to, tell Virginia's larger population what to do? That makes sense. The reason, however, that they gave the state special status in this sense was, number one, to get the Constitution passed. It was a political deal. They had to get the small states on board somehow, and this was the way they did it. They said, okay, look, we'll do population in the House, and we'll do states in the Senate. And that sort of was a balance that allowed them to do that. The other thing, the reason why this made some sense in those days, 1787 was not long after these states had been independent colonies. They didn't have anything to do with one another. South Carolina had nothing to do with Massachusetts sort of in 1760. I mean, they were all related to the British crown, but they didn't have anything to do with each other. So they were in some sense sovereign. They were like little bitty countries in a sense when they broke off from England. And so what the Constitution was all about was about getting all of those little sovereign entities together into one group and working as a group together. And even basically giving up their sovereignty in order to have sovereignty for the whole country. Which is a great idea and brings us to where we are today, the United States of America. But we still have this legacy of this kind of anachronistic thinking that states are somehow, unique or independent. They're not just areas of land, which under every other aspect of our government, they are.
Anything can change. The Constitution can be changed. But is that likely? And if not, what does it mean, do you think, going forward? Will this issue only get exacerbated?
Yeah, I mean, this is an institutional arrangement. People set it up and people could change it. But it does seem, I mean, the process to change a U.S. Constitution is very onerous, takes super majorities in a couple of different arenas, which is going to give the small states that are benefited by this bias, they're going to have excessive veto power over. So I doubt this is ever going to happen unless things get to an even more extreme situation than they are now. But if we don't change this, what's going to happen is that the demographic trends of the country are going to continue and to diverge the small states from the rest of the country. The small states are going to get smaller relative to the rest of the country. They're right now much whiter than the rest of the country. That's going to get worse. We see the trend already that the difference in the small states have fewer minorities and immigrants than always in the last 40 years. You see a trend line, but it's getting worse in the last 20 years where the smaller states are actually getting whiter than they were, and while the rest of the country is diversifying in a fairly steady pace.
Chris Mooney is a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. You can read his essay on the U.S. Senate. We have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. The coronavirus pandemic caused more than a public health crisis. It also hurt the nation's economy. Rich Egger talked to an expert about what we might expect once the nation moves past the pandemic.
It's not known exactly when the pandemic will be in the rearview mirror, but Tom Sadler believes the economy will look different. Sadler is a professor of economics at Western Illinois University. He says we're starting to see some of the trends that might emerge in the post-pandemic world.
We're so much more comfortable with things like remote work that many of us that have the possibility of working from home are staggering our hours. Maybe we're going to the office a little bit during the week and we're staying home a little bit during the week with remote work. We've seen that a lot with remote learning in the educational environment, with a lot of the kids now either 100% online learning from home or some kind of hybrid model where they go a couple days a week and the rest of the time they're learning from home. It's probably the case that many of these advances will stay with us in one form or another. I know from the business point of view that it holds down on costs. If a lot of your workers can work from home, then you don't have to rent as much space or own as much space in order to operate your business. So that could be a cost advantage. And so it's a question of productivity. If their productivity is the same or higher by working from home, it makes sense to have more of a hybrid model where people work some in the office and work some from home.
Well, that could impact some businesses if workers are staying at home to do their jobs because they're not spending money on gasoline. They're not visiting restaurants or shops in the neighborhood of the office.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's a secondary effect on a local economy. And that's yet another way that a local economy will probably adapt over time. And so the extent to which the businesses can adapt and figure out what's going on and the consumers decide what their new consumer behavior is going to be, the economy will continue to transform.
Did anything surprise you as you researched pandemic economics?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of things. You know, I think that we just didn't have many examples, especially last year going into the recession in 2020, we didn't have many examples of deliberate recessions. So in our economics classes, we talk a lot about recessions in the past, the recession after the financial crisis in 08 and 09, and, you know, famous cases, the Great Depression, or the recessions that occurred in the 1970s with high energy prices and so forth. But none of those were deliberate recessions where essentially our economy was shut down in order to fight this pandemic. So it was kind of unexpected to see how this would unfold over time because we don't have a lot of experience observing this.
Well, you looked at past economic downturns. What about past pandemics and their impact on the economy? Or is the economy just so different today that you can't really do a comparison?
Well, that's an interesting question because the only real pandemic that we can compare this to is the one of 100 years ago, the flu pandemic, 1918. It went into 1919. And so we know some about this. But what's interesting about it is there wasn't a lot written about the flu pandemic of 100 years ago soon after it. And so essentially we went right into the roaring 20s, the roaring 1920s, which was a really strong decade for the economy. And we kind of moved right past that flu pandemic. Another reason was that it was the end of World War I. So World War I ended about that time as well. And so people were exhausted from World War I. They were exhausted from the flu pandemic at the time. So the economy recovered very quickly. Now, what's different now, 100 years later, is how much our economy is much more service-oriented. It's much more service-oriented. We produced a lot more stuff as a percentage of output 100 years ago than we do today. And so our economy is a lot different. So we don't have a lot to work with. It's hard to make a comparison between what's going on now and 100 years ago. So many things have changed since then.
Tom Sadler is a professor of economics at Western Illinois University. One of the courses he's teaching this year is called Pandemic Economics. That's also the title of an upcoming book he authored. Sadler believes the economy will recover in the coming months, though he cautions we will need to be patient. Rich Ugger reporting.
Coming up, the former head of the Chicago Teachers Union has died. We look back at the career of Karen Lewis. We're back on Statewide. The leader, credited with reviving the Chicago Teachers Union and setting off a wave of activism across the country, has died. Karen Lewis had brain cancer. She was 67. Sarah Karp with member station WBEZ has this remembrance.
Brothers and sisters, may I ask you please to see our love you too?
It was May 2012. Karen Lewis took the podium. In front of her, a sea of teachers in red filling every corner of the cavernous auditorium theater. Thousands were inside, and thousands more were outside.
We are gathered here today to show the world that we are united. We are gathered here to show the world that this is what unity looks like.
It was unlike anything Chicago or even the nation had seen in decades, maybe ever. Before Karen Lewis, the Chicago Teachers Union had been quiet, but then she ignited the passion of not just teachers, but people across the city and the nation. Those close to her say she'd most want to be remembered for what she stood for and for the nationwide movement she inspired against charter schools and privatization in schools and for the idea that public education deserves respect. Lewis laid out her positions in that speech at the Auditorium Theater.
Dreams and desires of everyday people who just want to be able to send their children to school in their own neighborhoods.
Lewis was deeply proud that she attended Chicago Public Schools and was a daughter and wife of teachers. She herself was a high school chemistry teacher for 22 years before being elected president of the Chicago Teachers Union in 2010. As president, one incident early on showed Chicago who Karen Lewis was. This is her recounting how then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel reacted when she called his push for a longer school day a babysitting initiative.
Well, who tell me say that? He jumped out of his chair and said, F you, Lewis. And I jumped out of my chair and said, who the F do you think you're talking to?
That is a story dear to the heart of every CTU teacher. Nora Flanagan taught with Lewis at Lane High School in the early 2000s. Karen made it clear that this was going to be a fight, and we all were like, okay, let's do this. And like, you know, took off our earrings and had someone hold our shoes and got ready for a big fight with a new, very powerful mayor. Flanagan says she was not surprised that it was Lewis in this position. She said Lewis was willing to challenge authority back then, too. At the time, she said, Lane still had the vibe of the all-boys school it once was and had a former gym teacher as a principal. Flanagan says most teachers felt lucky to be there and mostly kept their mouths shut at staff meetings. But this new chemistry teacher, Karen Jennings at the time, would raise her hand from the back or sometimes not raise her hand and ask hard questions or point out a flaw in our approach or just otherwise object to the plan. Flanagan says she's sure some did not appreciate Lewis, but she says many really liked her. Because here's the thing that people say over and over again about Lewis. She was warm. And though her humor could be biting, she was also super funny. She even spent some time as an amateur stand-up comic. Jackson Potter says her humor made it possible for her to bridge divides. Potter with Lewis and other young upstarts founded the caucus that took over the CTU in 2010. He was also a dear friend of Lewis's.
She always had people rolling in like our house meetings. There would always be a zinger. I think people would come just for that half the time. It also was a lifeline because people really could relate to her. She was human. She was hysterical.
Her warmth, wit, and intelligence are why even some of the people she once called villains waxed poetic about her when she retired. When she led Chicago teachers out on the first strike in 25 years, Mayor Rahm Emanuel seethed with anger. But when she left office, he sent her matzo ball soup and talked glowingly about her passion. James Franzik spent long, difficult hours with Lewis as a school district's chief negotiator, both in 2012 and in 2016.
My first impression was, wow, this woman is sort of off the rails. Didn't hesitate to use rhetoric that we weren't used to at the time.
Despite himself, he wound up liking Lewis. Like so many others, he talks about how engaging she was, how well-read she was, and how many languages she knew, at least three.
Karen is a force of nature. She envelops you with her charisma. She takes people that are natural adversaries and she charms them.
Current CTU president Jesse Sharkey says it's too easy to make Lewis seem agreeable and benign. Sharkey points out that Lewis was planning on running against Emanuel before she was diagnosed with brain cancer.
This is the person who Paul Rahm Emanuel, the murder mayor, was willing to sort of take on the powerful and the establishment. She's been a voice for black workers. She's been a voice for the underdog.
Sharkey and current Vice President Stacey Davis Gates said Lewis taught them to have courage as they led the Chicago teachers strike of 2019. Gates often pointed out during the strike that it was Lewis who laid the groundwork for much of what the union was fighting for. More nurses, social workers, and lower class sizes. Gates says one of the greatest things that Lewis did was build up others so they could take the baton.
You see all of the threads and the fruits of her labor manifesting in the way where now you don't have just the one. You have a mightier, you have a more stable, you have a chorus of voices basically shaking their hand and demanding the justice that she embodied as the leader of this union.
Not just in Chicago, but across the nation, Lewis's activism helped kick off the Red for Ed movement, giving teachers the might to demand respect and win it. And even though Lewis was ailing, she followed the last contract talks closely. Potter says Lewis demanded he bring her the agreement and went through it line by line. Lewis saw the contract as a big investment in public education and a victory for the fight she began so many years ago when she took over the Chicago Teachers Union. Potter says she was immensely proud and saw it as part of her legacy. Sarah Karp, WBEZ News.
nonprofit One Fair Wage recently released a report detailing treatment of Illinois restaurant workers during the COVID-19 crisis. The servers cited a marked increase in sexual harassment and at the same time a severe decline in tips. Maureen McKinney interviewed the report's author and One Fair Wage leader, Saru Jayaraman.
What does customers' response to COVID say about tipped work?
The industry has been devastated by the pandemic. 6 million workers lost their jobs. 60% of workers in Illinois, tipped workers in Illinois and around the country, could not get unemployment insurance because the state of Illinois and most states around the country told these workers that their wages were too low to meet the minimum threshold to qualify for benefits. So lots of workers felt compelled to go back to work in the summer and the fall, even though they felt it was too dangerous. Many workers did not want to go back to work, but felt they had no choice. And in going back to work, this report indicates what they encountered. They encountered going back to work for less tips and twice the responsibility. Tips have gone down 50 to 75%, and now these workers are being asked for lessened tips and a subminimum wage to serve as public health marshals enforcing social distancing and mask rules in what the CDC has named the most dangerous environment for spread. And the reduction in tips and the subminimum wage means that workers are more dependent on any customer that walks in the door. Customers have a lot more power over these workers than they had in the past. And that's problematic when it comes to hostility and sexual harassment in particular. The source of the problem of sexual harassment in this industry, even prior to the pandemic, was the power dynamic between male customers and women servers. The fact that male customers felt they could, you know, touch the women servers or treat them any which way, and the women had to put up with it because they relied on tips from those customers. They didn't get a wage from their boss like other workers. Now, with the pandemic, with tips greatly reduced, these workers are even more dependent on these male customers for tips. And the power dynamic is greatly increased, greatly exacerbated, and it's resulted in this issue of a subminimum wage going from a racial and gender and economic injustice to being a matter of life and death. Whole phenomenon to obliterate the mythology that tipping is based on the quality of the service. There's now years of research that tipping has never been correlated with the quality of the service. In America, tipping is correlated with the race and the gender of the server because Americans have what we call implicit bias. All of us have implicit bias. And so, unfortunately, unknowingly, customers in America tip white men more than women and women of color, even when the women and women of color provide better service. Women of color experience this at much higher rates than other women, and it's historical. As first tipped workers to be paid a subminimum wage in the United States were Black at emancipation, and Illinois has actually a very prominent role in that history. Because at emancipation, there were two industries that wanted to pay former slaves a $0 wage and let them live off of tips. It was the restaurant industry hiring women, and it was the Pullman train company wanting to hire men. And as you probably know, the Pullman car porters in Chicago organized the first Black union under A. Philip Randolph and won the right to a wage rather than relying on tips. But the Black women who were hired by the restaurant industry were not so lucky. They were not in the union. They were not allowed in the union. And as a result, we ended up with a subminimum wage for tipped workers, not just in Illinois, but nationally. So this is an issue of both race and gender. And as I said, it impacts women of color so much more.
Tell me more about the sexually harassing behavior increasing during COVID.
The fact that men are now openly saying, I need to see your face in order to judge how much I want to tip you. I need to see your pretty face. I need to see your look. Obliterates the idea that they were tipping based on service. No, they were tipping based on appearance and a judgment about the woman's look. It also shows the farce of the whole system, even before the pandemic. And now here we are with customers blatantly saying, I need to see your face to tip you. It completely decimates the idea that this was ever about the quality of service. And what we need is a full minimum wage. Tips be there, but let them be an extra or a bonus, not the wage itself. Prior to COVID, our industry had the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States because of the subminimum wage for tipped workers. And we knew it was due to the subminimum wage because we actually did a study in 2014 in which we surveyed workers across the country, and we found that workers in subminimum wage states like Illinois are twice as likely to report experiencing sexual harassment on a regular basis as workers in states that require a full minimum wage, including Minnesota, not too far from Illinois, and California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Montana, and Alaska. Those seven states require full minimum wage with tips on top, and workers report one half the rate of sexual harassment in the industry in those states, not as dependent on the tips. They're not as compelled to put up with harassment from customers or to subject themselves to objectification by customers in order to get tips to feed their family. That was prior to the pandemic. With the pandemic, workers are reporting tips are down 50 to 75%. They're having to enforce these social distancing and mask rules. They're encountering a lot of hostility from customers when they try to enforce these rules. They're risking their lives every time they go to work. In Illinois, women are reporting, more than 40% of women are reporting that there's been an increase in sexual harassment, and about a third of the women said it was significant increase in sexual harassment. And then hundreds of women submitted horrifying comments by male customers along the lines of, take your mask off, let me see your face so I can judge your tips on that basis. Pull down your mask so I can see if you're cute. I'm reading actual quotes. Take off your mask, I want to stick my tongue down your throat. Hundreds and hundreds of comments that are horrific, that are outrageous, and that are life-threatening. These are now the only essential workers that don't get a minimum wage, and the only essential workers that are being asked to remove their protective gear for a chance to earn their income. For anybody in a restaurant, that is a life-threatening crisis when the servers feel they are compelled to remove their protective gear in order to get their income. We actually are now calling it masculine harassment because it's become a live phenomenon. We're seeing this very noteworthy shift in sexual harassment during the pandemic. The mask has become kind of a new weapon for male customers to kind of wield power and demand that women essentially strip.
Is there one finding in particular that you think is most important?
I mean, the finding that's most horrifying is the spike in sexual harassment. 40% of workers, more than 40%, saying that there's been this incredible spike in sexual harassment and that they're being asked to take off their masks. But when you combine that with the other findings, that 90% of workers say their employer is not following safety protocols, that nearly half of workers report that they know somebody in the restaurant, at least one person has gotten the virus, and a third of the workers are saying they know somebody who died from the virus. All of these things point to the fact that what these workers are experiencing has gone from being unjust, untenable, unsustainable economically to becoming a matter of life and death. And the Illinois legislature needs to respond to this by enacting a full minimum wage with tips on top as a COVID emergency measure. You know, when the governor led the fight for 15 in the state of Illinois, tipped workers were left out. When $15 was moving in the city of Chicago last year, tipped workers were left out. Tipped workers have been, as women, the chopping block, the negotiating point in every minimum wage increase over the last several years. And this is the result. This is the result of women being left out of the minimum wage increase. Masculine harassment.
That's Saru Jayaraman with the group One Fair Wage. It recently released a report detailing treatment of Illinois restaurant workers during COVID-19, citing a big increase in sexual harassment with a decline in tips. Sam Toy is president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. He issued a statement to us in response to that report. He says his organization condemns all forms of harassment in the workplace and supports legislation to require sexual harassment prevention training. He says tipped, hourly, and salary workers all deserve the same level of support and respect. You're listening to Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Illinois Innocence Project works on behalf of the wrongfully convicted. Last year, the organization hosted a benefit featuring Amanda Knox. She was ultimately exonerated after her wrongful conviction and imprisonment for the murder of her roommate when they were studying abroad in Italy. In the years that she was free on appeal, Knox wrote a best-selling memoir and became a journalist. Her book and other work has exposed problems in the criminal justice system, including false confessions, resources to fight wrongful charges, and unequal access to justice. Hannah Meisel had a chance to speak with her late last year. Today we listen back to that interview.
In the years since you were freed and ultimately exonerated, you've dedicated your work to others who've been wrongfully accused, and you've been involved in Innocence Project appearances. You know, in the American criminal justice system, there's a disproportionate number of Black and Brown people, and you obviously are a white woman. So how do you view your role using your privilege to, speak for those people?
Yes, I don't look like, and I don't have the background of most of the people who are wrongfully convicted and swept under the rug by the criminal justice system. What is true is that was in Italy, I was the other. I was the American girl who, there were a ton of stereotypes, conceptions about what an American girl was and could be. So there was a lot of prejudice that I ended up facing inside the courtroom. Because I grew up here in the United States in a household that was stable and economically comfortable, and I had literally never, ever had even encounters with the criminal system before, much less like problems, I just did not know. It never even crossed my mind to know that human beings are going through this process here in the United States. And of course, it's something that our low income and our communities of color and minorities have known for a long time. But what I have found is an important part of my role since coming home is building a bridge between those who know all too well and those who don't. And so I'm sitting in this like weird position of people being able to relate to the experiences of those who are entirely different than them, with the understanding that it could happen to them. It could happen to someone like them. The truth of the matter is that like when you are accused of a crime, people can find ways to be prejudiced against you. And what happens is people feel comfortable being prejudiced against you in ways that they wouldn't otherwise, simply because you have been accused of a crime. That is what we see over and over again here in the United States, where it's young men of color most often. And like, how do you present your individual story when there is this overwhelming story that we've all internalized leading up to this one person who's on trial?
I was struck in the part of your memoir when you detail the very beginning of, you know, all the questioning that you went through. You had basically a coerced confession and, you know, false memories. And so, you know, here in Illinois in the 1970s and 80s in Chicago, we had a police commander, John Burge, and he oversaw the coerced confession by torture of more than 200 men who, you know, would later turn out to be innocent. The city of Chicago is still paying out, you know, settlements to those families. You experienced this in a different way. You weren't physically tortured, but you were days on end with very little sleep. You did not know the language. And, you know, here in the States, of course, people who get caught up with law enforcement, especially, you know, in immigration situations, and they aren't proficient enough in English to, you know, fully grasp what's going on. And, you know, sometimes they're made to sign things that they don't fully understand. What does that tell you about just the power dynamic that exists when someone is accused?
I was not beaten. I was slapped. But regardless, you do not need to be having your fingernails torn out to be psychologically manipulated. Question everything you know to be true and to go along with whatever narrative the police are putting in front of you. Hardest part of explaining what it's like to be wrongfully convicted is precisely this point, because it's so difficult for people to understand how atrocious, how deeply manipulative and coercive interrogation techniques are allowed to be here in the United States and around the world. And yes, like, my rights were violated during my interrogation. I wasn't allowed an attorney, wasn't even informed that I was a suspect. There are a million ways that a human being's mind, when they're in a vulnerable state, when they are scared, when they don't understand what's going on, when they are faced with the impossible choice of, they're being told, like, you're either going to go to the death penalty or you're going to tell us what we want to hear. There are a million ways that any reasonable human being would sign statements or start to think that they must be crazy because they are being told, like, they are being treated the way that they are by these authority figures that we entrust with our justice system. The impact that those people have in those positions is tremendous. And for people who are young, for people who are foreign or don't speak the language, you are particularly vulnerable to that kind of manipulation.
The prosecutors in your case, you know, they seemed kind of hell-bent on saving face and sticking to their storyline that you and Rafael were the main conspirators in the case, even after police found evidence against Rudy Gadet, who was, you know, ultimately convicted of your roommate Meredith Kircher's murder. So what does that tell you about the nature of prosecutors, you know, obviously not just in Italy, but everywhere? Any thoughts about the standards that prosecutors should be held to? Any thoughts about whether they should even be elected officials like they are here in Illinois?
Yeah, there's a whole number of issues that raises, right? Prosecutorial tunnel vision, the decision to choose a narrative and follow through with it no matter what the evidence says, to pick and choose and cherry pick evidence in order to pursue a specific narrative as opposed to allowing the evidence to dictate the narrative that ultimately leads to the judicial conclusion. This is, maybe this is an unpopular opinion, this is human nature. Like, I don't think that prosecutors are especially like different than any other human being. They are human beings who, for better or worse, get their minds stuck on certain issues. And I don't think that you have to be maliciously intending to personally save face at all costs to come to believe your own narrative that you've built up based upon your like flawed gut feelings. So I think it's a very entirely human mistake that prosecutors are making over and over and over again. Of course, I'm not trying to exonerate any of the prosecutors who are actively suppressing exonerating evidence. That absolutely happens. But you don't have to be actively suppressing exonerating evidence to ignore it because it doesn't seem relevant to you, to your narrative of guilt that you are pursuing. So the kind of mental and emotional traps that prosecutors find themselves in, where they just get fixated on a person and are convinced that that person is guilty, the evidence be damned, is an entirely human thing that we can all relate to. And what it means is that when prosecutors are making their cases in front of the court, instead of acting like these sort of agents of justice, we need to recognize them for the human beings that they are. They are flawed human beings who are capable of making mistakes. They aren't just these sort of, you know, inhuman, superhuman entities who we can just sort of entrust to be representatives of ourselves, the greater world. We have to acknowledge that they can make mistakes. And they can be fixated on the wrong person for entirely non-malicious reasons even. So I think that we need to have legal protections that sort of prevent them from, or like that fix the incentive structures. You brought up like how prosecutors are elected officials, and that means that their conviction rates are often used as means for them to be, you know, reelected. It would be nice if they had conviction integrity rates instead of conviction rates, where if they notice that they've made a mistake in a conviction and they overturn it for the sake of justice, that is also counted as a point for them. Like there are a million ways that we can incentivize human beings to do the right thing instead of just pursue guilt and conviction rates no matter what. But we also could do better ourselves personally to recognize that they are human beings and not these superhuman entities when we enter into the court system. And when we, the people, act as the judges, when we're the jury and we are taking in what we are being told, we should acknowledge that these are human beings with incentives that may not align with truth.
In the era of COVID-19, we have seen explosions of outbreaks in congregate facilities, including prisons. And I'm wondering, you know, when the pandemic hit Italy especially hard in the spring, you know, if you were thinking of those women in the jail and the prison that, you know, you lived with, or women who are like them, and healthcare in jails and prisons, you know, what you've learned through your experience and in the last, you know, several years, you doing this work.
I cannot get out of my mind the fact that, first of all, we all know, it's well known that healthcare in prison is below subpar. But beyond that, there's the mental health problem. I was able to survive prison and maintain the sanity that I have today, largely because I was able to have visitations from my family members. If this pandemic had happened while I was in prison still, and I was unable to see my family for how many months has it been? Since March? I don't know what I would do. Like, I don't know. I genuinely, that would be the worst possible thing that could happen. And I cannot imagine what it must be like right now to be literally trapped in a place where this pandemic is spreading like wildfire and no one seems to care. Like, I'm of the opinion that yes, healthcare workers and nursing facilities need to get that vaccine immediately. So do prisons. So do prisons, because no one there has a choice. No one can do anything to protect themselves. And we owe it to them because we are forcing them in that position. It is our responsibility.
That's Amanda Knox, who was exonerated after her wrongful conviction and imprisonment for the murder of her roommate when both were studying abroad in Italy. She now speaks out about criminal justice, and she talked with Hannah Meisel. Illinois is failing to stem the tide of continual population loss that has beleaguered the state the last several years. That's according to recent U.S. Census data. Tim Shelley examines the latest numbers.
About 80,000 people left the land of Lincoln in 2020. It marks the seventh straight year the state has sustained a population loss. Aaron Alleman is the executive director of the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning.
It wasn't unexpected, I think, but it continues a disheartening trend that we've seen across the state is just that, you know, people are leaving Illinois, and the only state that saw a higher rate of population loss was West Virginia.
That population loss was most heavily concentrated in counties outside the Chicago area. But even in the handful of counties gaining new residents, the growth was modest at best.
It begs the question of what do we need to be doing to growing our economy here, and not just in the metro region, but statewide.
Indiana, Florida, California, and Wisconsin account for much of both the state's in-migration and out-migration. But the trend isn't Illinois' friend.
We are seeing people from across the Midwest moving in and out of Illinois, and more people moving out than moving in, unfortunately.
Alleman says Latinx immigration rates are also dropping off statewide the last few years. Growth in that population traditionally helps offset losses in other demographics.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We're glad you could join us, and we'll be back next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Be sure to check the website, statewideshow.com, for links to all of our stories. You can also find our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.